British Columbians did tell us tonight that they want us to do some things differently. They want us to work together. They want us to work across party lines, and they want us to find a way to get along so that we can all work for the province that all of us love so very, very much.
British Columbians have waited 16 years for a government that works for them, and we're going to have to ask you to wait a little bit longer until all the votes are counted and the final results of this election are known.
We're here to work with anybody. I see no reason why it can't last a full term. I don't. BC Greens know how to work with people and compromise. We're not in this for political gain. We're in this to ensure that good policy is put forward.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is May 10th, 2018, and this is episode 85. Politicoast is your weekly politics recap with a West Coast perspective. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support us at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Glenboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield, and today we're joined by...
Jillian Peasted.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Today is a special, I guess, anniversary edition of the election, so we're going to have you help us remember the year that was.
Yeah, it was just a year ago. I guess it would have been officially Tuesday, but yesterday, yeah.
First, before we get into all that, we have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. And this week, we got to give a special shout out to Neil Genereux, our latest ministerial supporter. And we're inching closer and closer to our new $200 month random arbitrary goal that once we hit, we'll start putting on monthly pub nights here in Vancouver. We're also in partnership with BC Today. If you're not getting this newsletter already, you should. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's going on in the legislature if you're not there. Sign up for a free two-week trial at britishcolumbiatoday.ca. Use the offer code Politicoast, all lowercase, to get 25% off once you decide to stick with it. Jillian, who are you?
Who am I? Today I am just a regular run-of-the-mill British Columbian, but the reason why I'm kind of here today, and we've kind of been Twitter friends for a little while, this is actually the first time we've met in real mm-hmm. life, I think. So the reason why I'm here today, so I used to be a BC Liberal Party staffer. I was running the digital campaign this time last year. I guess I would have been slightly hungover and very much sleep deprived and a little bit confused, to be honest with you, not really sure what was going to happen next.
We held a live show on that night. And we're going to record, it was our first live show. We were going to record our reactions once the results were in. Instead, we just got drunk and like rambled a couple times in the night. It was a great show.
Yeah, you know, for us, it was really weird because I had these pictures from election night in 2013. So I guess before I go on the story, I was a BC Liberal staffer for 3 years. I had these photos available to me from election night in 2013, where obviously everyone was really, really celebrating that night. And there's this really fantastic picture of Christie with the big champagne pour and everyone's partying. And I've kind of really always played that thought over in my head. I always thought, you know, maybe that would be me someday. And so, you know, it was a pretty interesting night that night, kind of waiting, like, are we going to bring out the champagne? Are we not? Are we not? Are we going to do it? And it was just kind of, it ended in a very purgatory way, I guess. But yeah, so I, this time last year, was the manager of the digital campaign. I had a team of 6 or 7 staff with me. It was 28 days of like pure, just hard work. Like I said, not a whole lot of sleep, a lot of Twitter battles. mm-hmm. And it was, you know, like overall just a lot of fun. I kind of came into politics in a really backwards way. I was a journalist before I was with the BC Liberals. I never, you know, in my wildest dreams when I was younger, when I was in university, ever thought that that would be something that I was doing. But Christy Clark was somebody who really inspired me. She was a woman who was often the only woman, and she was sitting at the head of the table every single time. And she was somebody who taught me a lot. It was a really hard 3 years. It taught me a whole lot, and I'm super grateful for the experience. I'll probably never do it again. Don't quote me on that, but I'm quite certain I'm still getting over that hangover a year later now. But so I thought today we could do just a quick rundown of the year that was, because it was obviously a pretty crazy year.
And before we jump into that, you have a new project you're working on.
Yes, I do. So that's another reason why I'm here today, because Politicos is getting a new friend.
We love all the politics podcasts, as it were.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we all have a pretty good, we're not super competitive with each other. So tonight, if you guys all tune into your favorite podcast app, you will be able to download the very first episode of Majority of BC, which is... it is actually a riff off of a Facebook group that I'm not sure. Are you a part of it, Scott?
I don't think I am.
No. So it was a Facebook group that was started by Ryan Pinio, who is my host of the show. You guys may also know Mark Marison. He's a senior BC Liberal strategist, as well as Dimitri Pantazopoulos, which I may have said wrong. But he's also a moderator. You know, it's kind of represents that coalition. Dimitri's from the conservative camp. Mark Marison, obviously a huge high profile liberal. Both worked really closely together in the Christy Clark government. So this Facebook group started getting pretty big, and there was this demand for this content where people could talk a little bit about, you know, licking their wounds a little bit. I think that's kind of what it was born out of. It was born out of this frustration. And one of the things that I, you know, as the digital captain of the BC Liberal campaign, you know, one of the things we really noticed and really fought for 3 years, it was kind of one of those things, it was a slow battle for me, was trying to get people in the BC Liberal Coalition online and actually talking and engaging, because we are really outnumbered by our opponents in the NDP and the Greens.
Young socialists on the internet.
Yeah. And that was it was a huge challenge for us, for sure. Right from the time when I started the job in 2014, when I was kind of given a mandate by my boss and the former president of the party to really modernize the party and to really try and bring pick our digital socks up a little bit. So it was something that I always really tried to get these people to do. And I kind of always, sometimes you'd have to resort to these scare tactics, like, you know, we're getting outnumbered out there, you know, and we tried everything we could and we got to a pretty good place. I mean, Team BC 2017 was a pretty good hashtag at one point in time. Definitely got hijacked by trolls, but such is life. I'd be doing it all wrong if that wasn't the case. Yeah, so it was just something that, you know, I think everyone realized was too little too late. And when all was said and done and John Horgan was called on to form the next government, I think there's just a big group of people out there who had a lot of opinions and who really needed a platform. So Majority of BC, the Facebook group was started. And then we thought, kind of, how do we take this a little bit further? So I was approached to help start up this podcast. So I'm the executive producer of it. It's dropping tonight. Like I said, Ryan Pinio, the Facebook group moderator, he is the host. And every single week, we're going to have different guests. And that's very much our value proposition. It's a little bit distinct from you guys, because it's obviously very much an insider BC liberal camp, right? Every week, it's going to be focused. You know, one of the things I really don't want it to get to is an echo chamber. Sure. You know, like, yeah. I want to make sure that we're using it. And this is part of the reason why I was brought on for editorial control quality, was just to make sure that we have fresh ideas and we make sure we have a diversity of voices going in there. It's not just about, you know, beating up on the NDP. It's about what do we do to move forward, and how do we make the majority of BC, 60% of the people who did not vote for an NDP government, how do we make sure that we are actually doing something productive about that?
Great. We'll include links in the show notes so that people can help find that.
Can I hear it?
We'll probably give you a little boost on Twitter. Cool. I guess I should also shout out West Coast Views, which is like the green version of what you're talking about, with friend of the show, Ryan Clayton. We might have mentioned him before, but just so, you know, and if eventually NDP hack podcast starts up, no offense.
That's exactly
what
it is. We
can give them a shout out too.
Yeah, no, and I guess we can also shout out our friends. Obviously in the BC Liberal camp, we have our friends at ICBA Cast. We wanted to make sure that we were a little bit different from them. Obviously they're producing really great content, but they're really doing it from sort of a quote unquote free enterprise perspective, really strong on those jobs in the economy. So we definitely want to be different from them as well. Make sure that everyone gets their own piece of the real estate.
Well, let's change tacks and go into the main segment, A Year for the Books. So as you mentioned, it's been a year since the weirdest, I guess, election in a long time in British Columbia history, with that effectively tied result, which is historic. I think one other time in BC we've had something so unclear. But before we get to that, I think it's good to talk about the campaign. And I think this will be, we had the recent episode where we talked with Rob Shaw and Richard Zussman about Matter of Confidence, and parts of this might be a rehash of that. That's a good book, and it definitely informs what I'm probably about to rant on about. But let's look at the campaign. And so you were involved on the one side. How did you see that? that campaign shape up?
Well, I'd love to just tell a story of actually the writ dropped on the 11th. Fortunately, my grandfather passed and I had to go to the States to go to his funeral. And I was uploading the platform from the airport in Phoenix. it was very kind of the team to allow me to go and do mm-hmm. that at such a critical time in the campaign. But I was given the platform and we were doing some promos of the platform pieces the day before the writ dropped, so the 10th. And one of those pieces was the tolls capping, so the $500 cap. And I remember getting that and I remember thinking to myself, I don't know what it was, but I had this feeling in my gut and I said, they're going to see this and they're going to raise us one, you know?
Yeah.
And that's precisely what happened because that news went out. It was kind of a slow news day. There was a lot of other things going on. It did not get the pickup that I was hoping to see as a digital strategist, obviously looking online, not seeing very much traction. Then obviously the reporters are going to John Horgan, they're going to the NDP camp and they're asking them for official comment and they're not saying anything. So as time goes on and on, I'm thinking, oh no, oh no, oh no. And then of course the next day the shoe drops and that's kind of when I knew this is going to be a very competitive campaign. The BC NDP are in it to win it. They had some sort of new voices and new strategists and new ideas coming in from the back room. Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew this is going to be really, really competitive and it's all going to come down to the Lower Mainland. So I would say right from the get-go, I kind of had that feeling right from April 10th. And I would say that that feeling definitely played out right till the end.
Well, and I'm assuming like most of the province, you didn't know how spontaneously the NDP reacted to that until you read the book or saw the previews for it, right?
You know what? Yeah. When I read the book, I just kind of went...
And that's a story of how they basically had the strategist there who went, oh, they're doing 500. Let's just make them free, figure out how to pay for it. And we're announcing it in like 2 hours.
Yeah. No. Yeah. When I read that part of the book, it was just, yeah, it was one of those things where I just went, oh yeah, I knew that. It was almost like I felt like I wrote that chapter.
From the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. The policy wonk in me wants to pull my hair out at that story, but it's good politics.
Yeah. No, it is.
So that sets up the campaign in the Metro Vancouver and this affordability aspect. And that's, I think, what the NDP was trying to run the whole campaign on was BC's doing well as a province. No one really denied that. The numbers were there. But the NDP played on this affordability aspect. Like, it's doing well, but it's not doing well equally or for everyone. And that helped, I think, them play this angle of going after Metro Vancouver voters, going after those suburban voters who felt like they were paying too much for tolls, paying too much for healthcare, paying too much for this, that, and other things. And that creates a lot of focus on Metro Vancouver, which is where we saw John Horgan spend a lot of time. And
all
it paid
time.
Off.
Yeah. Like, need I remind you, so there was the troll truck. I think maybe we've all forgotten about that. But not only was there the troll truck, but there was also a campaign that we did where it was the countdown of when is John Horgan going to leave the Lower Mainland, mm-hmm. right? And that was another one where I thought, you know, it from a strategy point of view, good one to get under his skin a little bit, right? But from an overall perspective, like the gut check that I did with this was, I don't know that this necessarily matters. Although I will say, the NDP did pull off that strategy in the end, but they did it at the cost of two, mm-hmm. I guess actually three NDP stronghold ridings. My good friend Doug Klovechuk, who worked his bottom off from, you know, before 2013. He was a candidate in Columbia River Revelstoke in 2013. He never gave up. I mean, he took the lawn signs down when he lost in 2013, but he, you know, he kind of put them back up right away. Like, he never gave up and he worked his ass off every single day to try and win every last vote, and he did. Also, a big shout out to my friend Ellis Ross up in Skeena too, because that was one of those ones where it could have gone either way. Obviously, in both those ridings, the incumbents were not rerunning. There were some nomination issues within the NDP camp because of their pursuant to their constitution. But Ellis Ross was another huge, big ticket candidate who did a really, really good job. And then I guess the last one would have been obviously Cowichan Valley went green. Which, you know what, props to Sonia Firstenau. You know, we don't see eye to eye on everything, but when I was watching the Shaunigan Lake thing go down in 2015, 2016, she was just a superstar. So in terms of when you go back to politics, politically speaking, choosing her as the Green candidate there was absolutely brilliant because she was very well liked. She had a really great base from her advocacy work that she did there. So it was a really natural jump for her to go and put her name forward as MLA. And then I guess the last one would have been Saanich North and the Islands, right? Which in 2013, mm-hmm. if you actually look at that poll, it's
down to the
wires. Yeah. It was actually split third, third, third. Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, they picked up a bunch of seats. You know, I think North Vancouver Lonsdale should have been more competitive than it was, but it went NDP. Port Moody should have been more competitive than it was. Maple Ridge Mission, which is actually, you know, there was some conservative vote that really cut in there as well. Mm. But yeah, I would say that they did, the lower mainland strategy paid off, but at the cost of some other strongholds around the province.
Well, and it like paid off as literally as it could have, like...
Yeah, just barely, like, right? Literally.
It was the minimal amount that they could do to win, which
exactly
resulted in this really tight, nerve-wrenching election night, which, as we mentioned, gave us no clear result for, it felt like hours, but it was weeks.
It was 2 weeks, yeah.
Because there's that 9-vote difference in Courtney Tomott's.
Yeah, there was. It was absolutely insane to think that it came down to 189 votes. And so now everyone who says, you know, every single vote counts, well, just look at British Columbia in 2017. Like, we got put in those textbooks about that. Like, we are a Wikipedia note if there ever was one.
Well, we didn't at least have to get down to the coin flip, or I think people were trying to figure out what happens in a tie in BC.
Yeah.
And I totally forget. I remember looking that up. But I know there in some provinces it is a coin flip. In some they draw lots. In others it's just a re-election.
Wow, yeah.
In any case, it's kind of ugly. But
I'm pretty sure it was one of the random draw, whether it was a draw or a coin flip, but don't think it would have led to a re-election.
So we have this long undecided period. Christy Clark takes the opportunity to say, I'm going to lead a minority government again. But you were in that room on election night, right?
What did
that feel like?
You know, so I actually got pulled off of the digital campaign on the last day to go to Burke Mountain. And Burke Mountain, Coquitlam Burke Mountain is the full name. That's Joan Isaacs. I think she won by something like 70 or 80 votes.
Yeah, that was the other one that was super close.
It was very squeaky. And my friend Jazz Johal in Richmond, Queensborough was also around the 80-90 mark, which was a brand new riding. British Columbia has never had that before. And Coquitlam Burke Mountain is one of those ridings that's like very bellwether, right? It goes back and forth, back and forth. So that night for me, you know, I keep coming back to that party. You know, I drove home so, you know, with the radio on, my phone was dead, was door knocking all day, doing polls, drive back to the waterfront, get ready. I had to buy a new outfit at the Aritzia. Thank goodness that our campaign office was close to a mall in Coquitlam. And I got there and I think everyone was just waiting to have that first drink. And that first drink didn't come till like midnight or something like that, you know?
And even then it's kind of a trepidatious, like, what's happening?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was just, it was the most bizarre feeling ever. You know, it's like you worked so, so, so hard. For me, it was 3 years, and you know, but it was like every single day for that 28 days. And for there not to be a solid conclusion was, yeah, it was definitely an interesting moment for sure.
So moving on, after the election, there was that up in the airness as everyone was kind of scrambling to figure out what happened. So what was going on kind of in the 2 weeks between the election and the recount?
For me, a lot of editing, what does our caucus look like on our website? You know, there was just, it was, like I said, it was just this feeling of where do we go next? Is this an opportunity? Trying to gauge what Andrew Weaver's next steps were going to be. You know, it was really, I kind of always knew in my heart, though, that he was going to go with the NDP. It just, again, we come back to Sonia Firstenau. Like I said, I followed her really closely when she was such a big advocate in the Shaunigan Lake issue there. I kind of knew in my heart that that's the way that it was going to go down. But of course, at the same time, being a partisan staffer for so many years, you know, you're just like, you keep checking your phone every 2 seconds, like you're refreshing Elections BC. Like I would love to get the data analytics on, you know, the traffic that was to that website in those 2 weeks, because I think there was even a day where it went down for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and even on election night, there was something going on in Andrew Weaver's riding where his results weren't coming in. And everyone was pretty confident he was getting reelected, but Like the phone lines were down or something ridiculous.
There was a power outage, I think, or something. But they actually had to drive the results down to the Elections BC office.
That probably comes back to some of the changes recommended that we can get to a little bit later. But
yes. I'm all about voting on the blockchain, but that's another episode. Yeah, no. So I think that 2 weeks, it was really just, you know, as somebody who was so emotionally attached to it, it was being somewhat resigned, but also, yeah, refreshing my phone all the time, constantly on Twitter, you know, out with my friends who I haven't seen in a month, like, come on, have a drink, have dinner. And I'm still just sitting there refreshing Twitter, just trying to hold on to, you know, any last glimmer of hope. You know, but there were celebrations as well. I mean, like I said, I got some really, really amazing people elected. Like to see that really emotional video when Ellis Ross was elected, former Haisla chief. It was a really, really emotional time for him and his community. And it was a really, really beautiful moment. Like I said, Doug Klovechuk was another one. And, you know, I think there was this feeling in our party, the people who knew that they were also kind of on the same page as me. They kind of knew the fate. There was also, you know, I think some people who genuinely thought this was an opportunity to do something new, like to turn the page. So there was a little bit of that going on as well.
Well, the turning the page in a way happened fairly quickly for Clark when she introduced her throne speech. And this came right as the NDP and Greens were starting to announce their confidence and supply agreement. And this throne speech she introduced, which was largely nicknamed the clone speech, because it seemed to pick up literally everything from the NDP and Green platforms, even the things that didn't go together. And that was one of the weirdest things to watch. How did it feel from your end?
I'm going to be honest with you. So for me, there was just this profound disappointment. Obviously, I knew there was going to be something going down. Obviously, the strategic move, and again, not privy to this because I didn't work in government. I was working at the party office where we had a ton of work to do after the election, filing paperwork, cleaning up our office. Like our office just had, you know, it's the scale, it went scaled up to 100 and something people in our office, and it went right back down to the skeleton staff of 5 people. So we had a lot of work to do. I wasn't privy to those conversations that were happening in the premier's office or in the deputy minister's office, I suppose, or in the public service or anything like that. But I, you know, when I was sitting there watching the TV with, you know, the office assistant, and I was really disappointed. You know, I thought it went a little bit too far. I think it went too far. And I was really disappointed because I thought, you know, if that's what we could have run on, if we could have put even just some of that in the platform, we could have saved those 189 votes. You know, I come back to that riding of, you know, North Vancouver Lonsdale. We should have talked about housing a little bit more competitively. You know, before the show, we were chatting a little bit about fundraising. You know, one of the things as a digital strategist that I saw online was that the fundraising issue, let's call it, was definitely resonating with voters. And I think there were some people in the camp who said, oh, it's just the chatter class, you know, it's just the Twitter class who's having these conversations. You know, the average British Columbian is not talking about this at their dinner table. And, you know, respectfully, I really did have to disagree on that because you had those advertisements again, the NDP, like I said, they were very competitive. They had those advertisements that really went for our character of our leader.
Well, and I can't imagine, like, the average British Columbian maybe doesn't care about, like, the specifics of how you do it. But it's that image and that perception of, is your party owned? Is it bought?
Absolutely.
And when you're like, oh, well, maybe one day we'll get around to thinking about changing some rules. And you've had the New York Times, for fuck's sake, come out and call it the Wild West of BC. Yeah. It just didn't look like enough.
Well, and, you know, just to bring it back, you know, to 2015, even with the federal election. I'm not that involved with federal politics. I've voted for different parties at different times in my adult life. And what I would say is that I remember in 2015 talking to some of my friends who are not politically involved at all. And when we get to PR, I'll have a conversation about the same group of people. But, you know, they would say to me, oh, Jillian, you're smart and you're politically involved. Who should I vote for? And I say, well, you know, like, here's the pros of Stephen Harper. Here's the pros of Justin Trudeau. Like, those are the two choices in the BC Liberal camp. From my perspective and being a true BC Liberal, I've voted conservative and I've voted Liberal in my life. And they go, well, I can't vote for Stephen Harper. And I always like to press people on that a little bit to see how much they actually knew. And so many of the people in my sort of age group, I'm 28, university educated people who just are not politically involved, they just saw something, you know, like Stephen Harper eats babies for breakfast on some, you know,
I mean, he's never denied it.
on some poorly made meme that someone made on, you know, Microsoft Paint in 19 whatever, and Windows 99. And, you know, you press him a little bit harder. You say, well, what is it about Stephen Harper? And I mean, he absolutely had his faults, but they weren't able to come back and say anything. So what I'm saying is that there's this big group of people out there now. They see one negative image on social media, and it's got a little bit more urgency and trustworthiness, and you know, it feels a little bit more official and personal when it comes from somebody that you trust and that you're friends with. So I think there was a lot of that going on for sure. And so I would argue that I think that we should have put it in at least the platform. I was disappointed that we didn't put it in the platform. I mean, to be fair, we were talking earlier, Scott and I, about, you know, the fact that we were going to appoint an independent panel to basically look at these fundraising rules. And Christie's argument was that, you know, politicians shouldn't be deciding who, you know, cuts the checks or whatever, which I think that argument has merit. But I would have loved to have seen us, you know, at least put it in the platform, because I think it came 3 or 4 weeks a little bit too late.
So that takes us through the clone speech, and that was followed up by a couple bills to that effect. I think the campaign finance came forward in there, and they forced the NDP and Green to vote against them. And it was actually impressive how once they'd signed this confidence and supply agreement, which we'll get to in a second, they just like became a block, and they're like, we're bringing the Liberals down. They voted no at every chance. I think they killed a bill on first reading for the first time in BC history, which is just one of those weird little facts. Usually everything like at least gets to be considered. They wouldn't even let the Liberals introduce the bill. I mean, it's what they had to do, right?
Yeah.
Or, well, they, I don't know if they had to, but
it was political. It was all political at that point in time, right?
Yeah, it was staking out as strong a no position as possible.
Yeah, and it was for the 6 o'clock news too, you know, which I guess is not technically the 6 o'clock news anymore. It's more like the tweet from Richard or Rob or Binder or whoever. But yeah, I think there was a lot of that going on, because one thing that we haven't talked about yet, and I think we're probably getting to it, is that there was a very real chance of another election. These guys, like, you come back to election night that year ago that we're talking about now, where John Horgan, you guys might recall, he didn't actually ever concede. Like, when he went in and did his speech, it was like, I'm not saying anything until the fat lady sings. In this case, a very thin lady. But, you know, I think there was 3 victory speeches that night. One of them had a decidedly sort of downer tone. One of them was like very hopeful. And then there was Weaver, who was just ecstatic, right?
He's like, I got 3 people on my caucus. Best Green in the North America.
Exactly. So these guys were still campaigning right down until that call that John Horgan received.
So they passed the non-confidence motion, and Christy Clark takes her sad walk, and the description of that in Matter of Confidence.
That's sad. I'm going to push back on you on that. It was like,
sorry, the description in Matter of Confidence was pretty like somber, is maybe a better word.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine, like I said, I'm a huge fan of Christy Clark. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine going through that in such a public way, having helicopters following your vehicle to the lieutenant governor's house. I mean, she had cameras in her face, and she just got, you know, in the most public way, defeated. But I still, you know, obviously these were all my friends, people who worked really, really hard and who really believed in her, all standing there lining the halls of the legislature, clapping and cheering her on. And I would have just been a mess. But she was like she handled herself with a lot of grace in that point in time, I thought.
And then Judith Guichon calls John Horgan fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. We still don't know what was all said in there, but we do know Christy Clark asked for another election right after she said she wouldn't. I mean, people push back on that. I think it's what she had to do.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. You know, admittedly, and it comes back to that, you know, like I said, it was just this like flip flop of what's going to happen. I booked a flight to Germany leaving the 27th, and I booked that in February because it never occurred to me that there would be an in between. It was, we're going to win a majority on the 9th or we're going to lose. Like there was only 2 copies of the speech, right? Until there were 4. And, you know, it was just so, I was actually on a plane when all this was unfolding, and I'm really glad I was, because I know it was a really emotional time for a lot of people who had worked in the legislature for a really long time, a lot of people who had worked really hard, really, really good, honest, hardworking people. And so I'm not too privy to any of those details, but I want to say that it was probably the most page turning part of the book for me in A Matter of Confidence, was that end part. I thought they did such a beautiful job of mixing everybody's narratives together. And I thought, you know, from the people that I talked to who were in the room from our camp, they said that it was pretty accurate and that they really nailed the tone from their perspective.
Well, one thing we have kind of passed over a little bit is the supply and confidence agreement that got put together and the negotiations around that. So yeah, what was kind of going on in the back rooms while that was being worked out and negotiated?
Again, I wasn't in the back rooms, and the people who were in those rooms were very, very much hard at work, right? Fighting for their lives. And again, I was away. I was off mm-hmm. and having fun in Europe. But my understanding of it was that the BC Liberals did try to negotiate in good faith. I think I'll give you a little sneak preview of our podcast that's dropping tonight, because we talk a little bit about this. We actually had an insider with us on our first show. I think that one of the things that, I think we did try to bargain in good faith. I think one of the things, though, was that ultimately, if we were to win the support of the Greens, I think that it would have just been the BC Liberals and the Greens were just way too far away on some things. And in the long run, it actually, I think, would have been detrimental to the BC Liberal Party, because they would have had to make such fundamental changes to the things that they really believe in. Sightsee,
right.
Kinder Morgan, those are probably the two biggest ones there, right? It really did come down to natural resource development. So I think that in the long run, everybody must have known that. That's pure conjecture, but that's probably what I think.
Sitting from the outside, it always seemed like Weaver was sympathetic. Whereas he was always on better terms with Christy Clark than he was with John Horgan. You could see that in the debates.
Oh, yeah, they were nasty with each other.
But prior to that, there had been a collegial atmosphere between the two of them. Christy Clark had passed a couple of his pieces of legislation that he'd brought forward, a couple issues. She'd taken them on, the heels in the workplace and the campus sexual assault mm-hmm. thing specifically.
Two big important bills.
Yeah. So I think my gut reaction was like, oh, maybe he's probably seriously undecided. He hates Horgan, but his platform is closer. I didn't know at the time, though, how much Sonia Firstenau hated Christy Clark on a deep personal level. For the Schwinnigan Lake stuff and all of that, but that kind of gave away the ultimate ending.
Yeah, and one of the things that I found fascinating about the book was the Ministry of BC Hydro. Mm. I mean, I never knew about that. I thought that was really interesting as a way to really sell Sightsee for Weaver and his supporters. Which, it was really interesting. I actually had the privilege of going to Sightsee on the campaign last year. I took the flight over there with the media. Mm-hmm. Keith Baldry was on my flight. Richard was on my flight. We went to Sightsee and I did a couple live hits there for the membership and our volunteers and all that, just to show people, because so few people get to see Sightsee. Mm-hmm. And I thought one of the things was, I think it is a good project for British Columbia. I think it's a massive project. Yeah. It's very expensive. But I think one thing I would have really loved to see was us sell it a little bit harder in a more retail way to a broader base of British Columbians. So I think it would have been cool to start talking about, where do electric vehicles fit into this? Like, how do we talk about that a little bit more? I wish that we had kind of moved away from just the jobs part of it. And how do we find a way to mm-hmm. make Sightsee applicable to people in Surrey and Abbotsford and Burnaby and whatever?
A new pitch that everyone gets an electric car.
Yeah.
Greens love electric cars. You could have sold them, or at least done a good job at trying to sell them on.
Might have been able to get 180 votes.
Might have, yeah.
So we get past the changing government and that goes smoothly, but things don't seem to calm down in BC Liberal land. There's rampant speculation from the moment Christy Clark loses the confidence vote that she's going to resign. And it seemed inevitable. It just wasn't clear what the timeline would be. We get to this caucus retreat in Penticton where everything kind of hits the fan, mostly because of Daryl Plekis, it sounds like. Were you involved at all in that? Okay.
No, I wasn't. I was still away. But I tend to agree with you on the fact that, for me, once John Horgan had been called upon and was sworn in and all that, he had his cabinet swearing in, which I think was on my birthday, actually, which was interesting. I thought to myself, how is she going to go from the premier's office to the opposition mm-hmm. benches? And especially when being the leader of the opposition is a really honorable job. It's a really important job. But especially when it was just so close, you know, and it was just like, it was, everything just seemed to just not work out ever so slightly. And I just thought to myself, how does she continue on like this? So when I heard the news, I remember I was on Twitter and I kind of, a tweet popped up breaking and I kind of went, you know, like it was almost like, yeah, of course. And then, you know, I realized how big of a deal that actually was. And I went, yeah, I guess it's because I kind of always expected this.
Well, we had this whole summer of piece after piece after piece about like the minutia of how the votes will break down, because if the NDP has to appoint a speaker, then everything will collapse. And the Liberals had put up their own speaker during the interim period, that first session of this parliament. And then he resigned right away, which was also a little bit unprecedented, but expected.
Yeah.
And so we just had this like, who's going to be speaker? Yeah. Will they even be able to pass a bill?
Well, and that's where another election really seemed likely, right? That was the one last thing, right? Every other scenario went, election's never going to happen and election's never going to happen. But when you looked at it like that, it was, how do we function in this way? It's almost next to impossible.
And will the BC Liberals kill everything in the Committee of the Whole, because it will just be tied there or slightly in their advantage? And well, that problem solved itself when Darrell Plackis said, I'll take the job.
Yeah, and but you know what? It's interesting. I was thinking about it on my way here. We have actually had a couple of illnesses since all that went down. And, you know, I think one of the, you know, obviously the BC Liberals, a lot of people feel that Darrell Plackis was very much a traitor. And I, you know, I agree. But I'm not as emotional about it because of the way I think about it is I'm very much, like I said, I'm not a total partisan hack. I can point out flaws and I can give credit where it's due. But I think one thing that he kind of saw the writing on the wall, the fact that this coalition was going to stick around and they were pretty much willing to do anything that it would take to make it happen. So I think I'm going to give him a tiny bit of credit when he says that, you know, there was this opportunity for him to go and do this job. Darrell Plackis is an academic guy. He got into politics because he was a community advocate. So I think I kind of understand why he did it. But again, in politics, loyalty is a really big thing. And I think that that's more important than anything else. But you look at some of the sicknesses and some of the accidents and whatnot. I mean, Dan Davies, MLA from Fort St. John up there in
that
North
weird
Peace.
Workplace accident, which talked about.
Can we talk about how badass Dan Davies is? He also works using like big, heavy machinery when he's on his off weeks from the legislature. He also used to be a public school teacher as well, which is
so is my
cool.
wife.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, this guy does a lot of different stuff. He is a real man of his community. So there was that accident, and we're really glad to see that he's back. And
that's good to hear.
Seems to be doing very well. I'm not sure if he's back in the legislature, but I know he's out and about. I've seen some tweets. There was the cabinet minister, I think her name's Lisa Baer.
Yeah, she's got a brain surgery or something intense like that.
She was quite ill. Then there was Steve, the former speaker, Steve Thompson. He was ill for a little bit as well. Yeah, there's been a couple for sure.
I've always kind of thought in those situations, just for fairness, like if one of your team members is sick, let's have a vote for vote kind of situation, because a bill shouldn't really depend on that.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're
everyone thinks like that. Yeah,
not in this one. I know Parliament, which is a bit bigger.
Yeah.
They can sometimes, or they'll work out in advance sometimes, like, I'm going to be sick, so let's just find someone to match me. And they'll be nice like that. But BC can be a bit more competitive, let's say, especially in a tie situation.
Never a dull moment.
So once Christy Clark resigns, that leaves the big open question of who's going to fill her shoes and become the next leader of the BC Liberal Party. So yeah, why don't you walk us through your experience there?
Well, just full disclosure off the top here, I did support Wilkinson and I did... big fan of Katie Merrifield, who's now the executive director of the BC Liberal Party, who is very, very capable, very smart individual. You know, when Katie Merrifield and Andrew Wilkinson call you and ask you to step up, you do it. So I just want to get that disclosure out of the way. But I think overall, Wilkinson was kind of a natural choice. You know, I even could feel it a little bit in his bones on election night. When I was standing next to him and having a conversation with him, I kind of thought, you know, some people in the room just kind of saw the writing on the wall. And I think that Wilkinson was definitely one of those people. He does have leadership is very much a part of his DNA. You know, I thought overall it was a fairly uninspired campaign by everybody involved. I thought Sam Sullivan was actually the most interesting.
He's always interesting, for sure.
He did receive my second ballot. You know, I don't think there was any surprises, really. I don't think anyone did a super standout job. I don't think anyone really screwed up too much. I don't think Diane Watts performed incredibly well.
That was really surprising, because she came from federal politics and had been the mayor of Surrey. And so people had this high expectations, I think, and were, oh, Diane Watts is coming in. She's going to swoop in, run away with it.
And she hadn't been in Ottawa all that long either. She was given up a fairly new position.
Yeah. And, you know, I was disappointed because I wanted to give Diane a shot because obviously I came into politics because of Christie, and I'm very much a hardcore feminist, and I wanted to see another woman on the stage because one of the reality of BC Poly right now, and perhaps soon to be all of Canada, is that in the next debate in 2021, is it? It's going to be three mid-aged white men on stage who all, you know, Weaver and Wilkinson come from pretty well-to-do areas. I think John Horgan's a little bit more blue-collar, but,
for sure.
You know, they definitely, there's no diversity happening there. And thankfully, you know, I think a lot of them staff their senior roles with women and all that. But I would have loved to see a woman kind of come in and take a leadership role there. And unfortunately, I just never really was all that inspired by Diane or what she had to offer or what she had to say. I think in terms of policy, I would have loved to have seen something a little bit more innovative, and I hope that that's coming down the pipe, something that kind of moves away from the party line a little bit and brings the BC Liberals back to a more innovative party, you know, proving that you don't have to spend a ton of money to get things done. I would have loved to have seen some of those ideas.
Well, and especially coming out of the election, like we were talking about, where that narrative developed, and we talked about it in those episodes at the time with the throne speech before the election. It was like, there's nothing in this. This is just kind of boring. And the budget was just like, well, things are still fine. It's like, people are worried about housing. Maybe like acknowledge that at least. And that became a problem.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I think, you know, one thing I do want to say is I do want to shout out Michael Lee, who was a newcomer to the scene, won his seat in Vancouver Langara for the first time in 2017. Somebody who I worked really hard with at the party when he was a membership chair, very, very intelligent individual. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting about him is that, all things considered, I think it was the best campaign in terms of execution. And I think that was large in part due to the staff that he kept around him. He had some of the most talented political staffers in the province, certainly on our side of the camp. And they all worked incredibly hard. And it sucked because I didn't get to see my friends for a month or 2 months or 3 months. But, you know, I thought that was one honorable mention for sure. In terms of new ideas, I'm not sure that there was like a ton of them, but they certainly had me fooled. I mean, Mark Marison worked really hard on every single online platform. He had the media basically eating out of the palm of his hand. Gary Mason writing article after article about, you know, how outstanding Michael Lee's campaign was. But when you actually, like in hindsight, look back, you say, well, what did he actually do? And what did he actually stand for? And it was just a really positive message that was really, really well executed. So I think that was maybe a highlight out of the camp that I found particularly interesting.
One thing that I did notice, at least a little bit, I have my ear to the ground in the BC Liberal circles, is that there was a very clear no Diane Watts camp that kind of was spread throughout all the other campaigns. You kind of touch on that a bit, on where those sentiments came from? Because I found that a very interesting feature of this leadership plan.
Well, I think with anything, when there's a clear front runner, there's going to be a lot of hate being thrown towards them. And I think from the start, and this is right when I came back from Europe, she was the media darling. I mean, Mike Smith was writing about her weekly, or if not like bi-weekly or twice weekly. You know, I think that everyone had really high expectations for her right out of the gate. She had, you know, big power players like Brad Zubik on her team. So I think a lot of that was really just generated out of fear. She was different. She was a woman. She was an outsider. She didn't carry the baggage that the three cabinet ministers on the stage did. You know, she didn't carry the baggage that the former Vancouver mayor had. She had way more experience than Michael Lee did. So I think it really just came out of like fear. As for, was it actually really realized at the end of the day on February 3rd when it came down to the vote? No. I mean, she was pretty competitive. She made it all the way to the second to the last ballot. So, yeah, I think I think that she did actually better than I was expecting in the end.
So we come to the result. Andrew Wilkinson wins on
the final ballot.
Final ballot, yeah.
And he started near the bottom and slowly worked middle. His way up through
middle. It was middle. Yeah, yeah, you can't start at the
Sullivan,
bottom.
Sullivan, yes. Sullivan, Stone, and DeYoung were towards the bottom. Yeah. And then Michael Lee, Diane Watts, and Wilkinson yeah. kind of remained competitive. And like I said, Michael Lee actually, he pulled it pretty far, and there wasn't a huge margin between him and Wilkinson on the third vote.
And it was like the third conservative leadership race across this country broadly with this like come from behind ranked ballot win after we saw Andrew Scheer do it at the federal level and or Doug Ford I guess did it
yeah
after yeah. Mm-hmm. And it seems like center right parties are having trouble coming to a consensus about which direction they should go, but he's been going from there, and I think that's a good way to pivot into what the government has been doing since they took office. I printed off the confidence supply agreement before we started and like kind of went through all the promises. They actually did fulfill quite a few of them very quickly in that first budget. I think that was a lot of them were low-hanging fruit and with quick legislation like the campaign finance reform, which generated a bit of controversy because of the timeline of it. They said basically it will come in a little bit later and
well,
we're bringing in some
money. Well, David Eby was on record for a very long time saying you could do this in 1 week or in yeah. one day or one afternoon or whatever. So yeah.
And we'd introduced the bill six times, but apparently those bills were not that great. But they got it done eventually. And in hindsight, no one's talking about that anymore.
It's true.
Or even the fact that public money is going to political parties. Maybe yeah. that will come back up eventually, but everyone's yeah. kind of just gone, oh yeah.
Well, now they're talking about lunch.
Yeah.
Of all things.
Oh, God, what a stupid week this has been. Lunch and emails. Things we're not talking about today.
I'm sure we'll probably hear about it when the next election happens and suddenly finance is back in the news.
Well, and you've got to think that Andrew Weaver's never had access to this type of money before, right? Whereas mm-hmm. the BC Liberals and the NDP are a little bit like, oh, this is peanuts compared to what yeah. they were operating on, especially when you look at the NDP's financial returns from after the election. You look at how much money came into them, and it just really goes to show that it does follow the government.
There was some fascinating stories. I forget who wrote them, probably Rob Shaw, I want to say, looking at just individual corporate donations that just like switched the day of the election or the day of the government's change
transition yeah.
on July 18th. And that is actually the only thing you can say for sure that they've broken out of this confidence supply agreement is the first promise they make, which is to recall the legislature within 1 month of swearing in of the BC New Democrat government. And for record, they were sworn in on July 18th and held their first sitting on September 8th. Which is
basically the first time you can do it after Labor Day anyways.
But they had sort of intended it to be like hold a brief session in August, I think. And then they got into government and went, wow, this actually takes a lot of effort to turn this thing around. And that's, I think, the story of this government. Like, they hit a lot of things in that first budget update and their throne speech in the fall, but this spring has really shown how much effort it is for them to get things done. They've been behind on bills. They're only like releasing the cannabis bills this last week. And the story of January, February, even early March was, what are they doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, no, like I said to you earlier, like I'm actually not super briefed up on what's been happening. You know, I think overall, you know, when I'm looking at how the NDP have performed in this particular session, it's been interesting because they've been pretty even keel. They haven't done anything crazy socialist yet. Like, you know,
it's not Dave Barrett.
You know, like the scare tactics, I'll say, you know, I took some flack. I actually got a bunch of unfollowers on Twitter because I tweeted that I thought the optics of Carol James introducing female finance minister, tabling her first budget as finance minister at a daycare, you know, with children, like the optics of that were something that I actually really wish that we could have done, because I think we really needed to soften our image with female voters.
Right.
Right. We needed to speak, like Wilkinson kept saying on the campaign trail, you know, we weren't speaking to people. We weren't speaking their language when they were sitting at the dinner table at night. And I think that that was really bang on. If you are tuning into the 6 o'clock news, which barely anyone is, but if you are and you see that image of Carol James sitting there with kids on her lap, it's a much softer look. It's a much more relevant look. You know, okay, the you know, relief may or may not be coming, because I actually think there probably is a lot of holes in this child care policy.
And it's like the first step of a giant program, which they always said was going to be a slow rollout. But
and hey, I'm all for it, because you know the way I look at daycare is that it gets women back into the economy, and you know, I think McKinsey did a report that said that it would be in like the hundreds of billions of dollars worldwide if women could get back to the
Jen workforce. Gerson, for the reporter in Calgary, has a very similar take, even though she's generally pretty center right. And it's just like, I'll go full socialist for child care.
Yeah. So, you know, I think those types of images were generally a good step, more relatable than a AAA credit rating or.
Which they still have.
Which, yes, I saw the memes. AAA credit rating or, you know, the Prosperity Fund, which I was never, ever a proponent of. I thought that thing was pretty silly, especially when we don't have a Broadway line built. We don't have any Surrey Transit built. You know, there are some other things that could have used that money for sure.
So on the strategy and digital stuff, how have they been doing, specifically on the digital aspect? Because, you know, that's the area you know most well. How has the government and the opposition done?
Well, you know, it is interesting. Governing is hard, as they say. And a lot of the things that they used to get upset with the BC Liberal government for doing, they have done, in fact, probably more blatantly. You know, like I'm thinking back to there was some ads on Twitter around school funding, which I think was a re-announcement of a BC Liberal commitment that was already in some, you know, multi-year funding introduced in budget 2017 or something like that. 16, I think, was quite a significant education budget. And, you know, the message, instead of saying, you know, we're investing X amount of money in school Y, it was like, after 16 years of cuts and children eating off the floor with dirty hands, you know, relief is coming. And it just was noticeably very quite partisan. They were definitely peddling the message of the day, and all governments do that, but I think the BC Liberal one was just a little bit more subtle. But I think those are growing pains. You know, I'm sure that they're going to grow into that role. Yeah, I think that so far I think it's going to be tough to topple these guys. I think John Horgan's performance overall has been pretty good. You know, on our podcast we did a bit of a panel of the performance of the front bench, and you know, I was trying to think about that. If you guys were going to ask me that today, I couldn't really name a whole lot of the front bench. Sure. But I would say that John Horgan has refrained from being angry John. I think you guys will remember that hashtag. I may have had something to do with that a little bit. You know, we haven't seen angry John. We haven't seen the prickly John who snarks at the media.
Yeah, we had that photo of him at Christmas, like lighting up the tree, and he was like the happiest child there.
Yeah, so I think overall, I think they've been doing a fairly decent job, better than I had expected, you know. But I think at the same time, they have to make some compromises, right? Because they don't have a majority. They have...
Well, the Site C dam was a huge compromise, and you could see that tear that party apart. You saw George Heyman and...
Lana Popham
and some of the others. And Michelle Mungall, especially.
She was at a funeral.
She was going to cry, yeah.
But they went behind the scenes, I guess, crunched the numbers and just went, yep, they put it over the line.
Yeah.
To the point where if we kill this, we are going to be broke.
Yeah, and I mean, John Horgan had a lot of different positions on Site C over his time as energy critic. And like I said, a little bit more of a blue collar guy than some of his more activist caucus.
Well, and that really came out with this weird pro LNG announcement they had a couple weeks ago, which we still haven't figured out where that came from, because it was suddenly like, oh, they're trying to out Christy Clark at LNG.
Well, and I'm like, why isn't Weaver? I mean, well, that was, he had
Weaver
bizarre,
went off the top. Weaver's gone off the top so many times.
Yeah, he had that bizarre press conference there where it was just like, you know, reporters just like have at me, basically, you know, which is something that these reporters are not used to, right? They usually have minister staff saying like, no, that's enough. And the ministers are getting ushered away. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, give him a microphone and he'll speak into it for as long as you can.
Yeah, we had a weird reaction where he was saying it was a breach of the confidence agreement, but also not, and wouldn't bring down the government over. The reaction was just confusing.
He has threatened to bring down the government like 3 or 4 times on Twitter, though, since, And that's kind of the contrast. Like, Horgan's been very even-keeled, like you say. He's done well, and he's kept his caucus and his cabinet especially in line, where you have divided personalities on there, but otherwise doing a pretty strong performance. I think Lana Popham had one thing she got in a little bit of trouble maybe for, like a letter to fish farms that was a bit more aggressive than I think anyone was used to, but was maybe still within what the NDP wanted to say. But other than that, they've kind of all had this united front.
Yeah.
And they've all looked competent at it, which can be tough for a party that's been out of power for 16 years and has to draw new blood into very difficult jobs.
Yeah, and there's a lot of jobs too to make that government go around. You think about how many people got fired and how many people they'd have to rehire to do those jobs as people who, you know, haven't ever had that opportunity before. It's definitely interesting times.
So it does look like this agreement will be lasting for a little while. And the biggest reason, at least, is whatever this referendum will be in the fall. So maybe let's talk briefly about proportional representation. And then as I look at the clock, we might need to move it into next sections.
Yeah.
But there's a referendum apparently coming up in the fall, but none of us know anything about it.
Yeah. I think that that's the biggest concern, really. And it comes back to, and I want to bring it back to retail, right? Because I am not a super policy wonk. I'm very much about like what makes sense to everyday people. And I bring it back to my same group of friends, university educated, bright people, hardworking people who still, as of June or July of last year, said, so what like technically went down after the election? And you're like, because they don't even understand first past the post, really. Mm. They don't really understand what happens when they mark their ballot box down, because you learn it in social studies at a young age. And then if you don't do it in university, or you don't go to university at all, which is a very privileged thing to be able to do, then you kind of forget about it. So I think, you know, my concern is that already voter turnout's super low. Most people don't know what the heck they're doing when they're doing that. And then the next thing is that proportional representation is so confusing, and there's so many different models, and I'm a marketer, and I'm, you know, I work in communications. I'm like getting anxiety just thinking about the education part that needs to go around that, like the campaigns they're going to need to do to educate a bunch of people. They're going to have to be super accessible. They're going to have to talk to seniors. They're going to have to talk to young people. They're going to have to talk to people with fixed addresses, without, you know, they're going to have to talk to people on email, phones. Like, there's just so much that needs to go down. There's not a question yet. It's just very, like, for me as a project manager in communications and marketing, I'm just like, you got to pull the plug. Like, we can't do this now.
Well, what was surprising was this week, it might have even been today, Angus Reid put out this poll around a lot of issues around the 1 year anniversary. But one of the big numbers in there was that 56% of British Columbians are in support of a unknown proportional representation system. And most people aren't concerned like we are. They're like, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter what the question is. We'll vote in for it. And I'm like, who are these people?
Yeah.
Well, I guess they're in caucus and cabinet right now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There was that email too, apparently, that just was leaked.
Well, the BC NDP put up a little like petition on their website to themselves to be like, I support proportional representation. If you signed that, you got an email a couple days ago saying, and this was after John Horgan and David Eby were like, we'll get the question out maybe in the fall. The fall seems fine. People don't need to talk about this over their barbecues. And we're all like, you being really anxious and like, what the fuck? That's stupid. And I think they heard that and went, oh, actually, we'll have the question out in the next couple of weeks. Yeah. So things are starting to rush a little bit more, maybe.
Yeah. What do you think, Scott?
I think it's going to be a tough uphill slog for the pro side of the referendum question. But I hadn't heard about that poll, and it does make me think they might have a better chance than I'd initially suspected. But it's also the thing that's holding the confidence and supply agreement together, at least for the next little while. So I suspect we won't see anything too crazy coming out of the Greens until the referendum comes down one way or the other. And then all bets are off.
Yeah, I do have concerns about stacking the deck for sure. Although I think one of the things that you and I talked about, this is a really spicy take for a BC Liberal, but I'm actually really undecided. I'm not an opponent and I'm not a proponent. I actually am one of those people who requires education. And because one thing as a millennial is I really believe in fairness. And I think one big check mark for the PR side, the yes, is that, you know, we, such a low voter turnout, we elect governments with like 40% of the vote or sometimes less. And I think millennials are really, really big on this whole equality and fairness. That's a big part of our narrative. It's a big thing that drives our everyday decisions. And so I think one big pro, especially among millennials, who again, don't know a whole lot, they're very impressionable. They see these graphics on social media and they go like, well, this system doesn't work for me and my vote doesn't mean anything. And they might tend to think if the PR side, and there's people like David Moskrop out there who are very intelligent and they're very, very good at spouting their message off, I think much better than the scare tactics that come from the other side, which is, this is an assault on our democracy.
This is how you get Nazis.
Yeah. This is how you get Nazis. And like, which I'm sure is true. Like, again, I see both sides of the story, but my concern is that the deck is going to be very much stacked. And the messaging on the other side is a lot more, especially in my demographic, which is now, I think, one of the biggest ones, if we actually end up turning out, is I think that that's a really good message. And it's something that speaks to me is like, well, let's have a look at this.
Well, it's actually weird. This is the one election that the seat count actually reflects the votes. Because it was, you know, 44. It's roughly, it might be a little bit still against the Greens, but
represented as always,
but it's the closest. I think what was it, the 96 election where the BC Liberals got more votes but lost? That was the election to make your case for proportional representation, and that's when they were for it until they were against it.
Right.
Any other quick thoughts on where this parliament or this legislature is going from here?
I think we're in for the long haul, to be honest with you. I think, you know, one thing that I found really interesting is Richard Zussman on his tour saying that he really thinks it's resting on this climate action plan. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see how anything that John Horgan and his government can say in that are going to negate the other things that he plans to push forward with. And I do think Kinder Morgan's going ahead. And I actually do think this government, I think John Horgan is just playing the cards that he said he would play, but I actually don't think he's as opposed as maybe some of his other members of his caucus are and the members of his party. But I do think that that's going to go ahead. I don't see how, you know, anything that he can say or do is really going to be that groundbreaking that it's going to please or appease, I guess, Andrew Weaver for the long haul. The next thing that I would say is that I spicy take, I think he's toast, this Andrew Weaver guy, because I do think, you know, a lot of the things that we talk about on my podcast is that there were a bunch of green voter or BC Liberal voters that bled green. And, you know, my Facebook friends included, how when Andrew Weaver ended up supporting John Horgan said, I want another election. Like, this is not what I wanted. This was a protest thing that I didn't think would end like this. And now I have voter's remorse. So I think that there is a huge number of those people. And so I think that they kind of look at this and go, nah, this wasn't for me, depending on how things go. And they come home or a new party emerges or something, what have you. But I think that the Greens are effectively toast because now his identity has really just like it's turned and green and orange actually don't mix very well. Like I can see it behind your head right now. Like it's just they don't mix beautifully like red and blue do or like, you know, it doesn't turn purple. It just turns to
it's all about the aesthetics.
Disgusting, right? And you just now you can't really differentiate what's Andrew Weaver and what's the NDP. And so I think that he's done. Maybe not him and his seat necessarily, but I think he loses the rest of his caucus.
I think there's a good chance they'll hold on to at least one or two of the seats they've got. I grew up in Saanich and the Gulf Islands area, so it's an area that's fairly friendly to the Green message, and I don't see Adam Olsen losing that support, even if you do get the BC Liberals returning to the fold.
It's interesting you brought up the climate plan, and the NDP introduced a bill in this last week to actually set back the BC government's carbon targets. I think the argument is we weren't going to hit the one, so we need to adjust them to be a bit more realistic, which they of course use as a partisan swipe because it's what you got to do when you're in government, I guess, or a new government. And Weaver was fine with that. He was actually like, all right, fine. We're committing to something at least. Mm-hmm. And BC's climate targets are still among the best in the country.
I was just going to say, it's like, it's not even a drop in the bucket, really, if you think about it. I mean, our neighbor down south, he's completely called it all off, and it doesn't really matter what we do, because we're basically nothing in terms of emitters. That's not to say that we shouldn't have a robust plan, because I absolutely think we should. And I think it's something that British Columbians really care about. And any party who wants to form government moving forward has to have a genuine, meaningful plan around that.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back continually to where the BC government is going. And this has been a fun look back.
I'll move on to Twit Tates. The chief electoral officer for BC's released some recommendations for changes to how elections are done in the province, specifically to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to pre-register, to modernize the process through which voting and counting is done. So I guess we won't have that quite as long a wait on election night next time if this goes ahead.
And I think part of it is like putting computers to count them. There'd still be paper ballots, though, like which the, is actually...
Yeah, like how we vote in the city here, where they get scanned in. Allow more personal info to Elections BC so they can keep the lists up to date. And perhaps most interestingly, they want to extend the election period by 4 to 10 days from the current 29 days.
Too long.
This was a weird one that got like controversial. David Eby actually like tried to pour cold water on this. And Elections BC's argument was to give a bit more time for candidates to get registered, for them to set voting booths up. It was all practical matters. They weren't like, we should spend more time debating the issues. It was just, let's just make this easier for staff who have a lot of shit to do in 29 days, as you know how a campaign goes.
Yeah, I think to me, I'm like, no more extra days. You know, like I actually think back to the 2015 election when Stephen Harper called that epically long one. And I've had friends on both camps and I just went, oh, you guys are out campaigning while I'm literally floating on Okanagan Lake. It's too long.
And the federal government's starting to finally look at changes to that. Although
that's not fair.
Well, and they're doing them at like the last minute, almost. So it's good that Elections BC is looking at this now and it gives time to bring them in. And so EB was positive on the allow 16 and 17-year-olds to pre-register. I don't think many people are against that idea, and so hopefully some of these go to reality. But something that was a little bit more controversial, when we touched on the BC Liberal leadership race, there was a story out in the Vancouver Sun this week about how much they all spent. And it turns out the BC Liberals did set in a cap of $600,000 for how much each campaign could spend, and that was... that didn't include the fees you transferred back to the party or any other transfers internally. So some people would obviously spend a little bit more. Diane Watts spent a lot more. She spent $1.1 million and Michael Lee spent $988,000. Wilkinson spent about $735,000, which he says works out to about the cap. But it turns out there's no repercussions for this.
You know, the people who spent the most in the campaign were ultimately not very successful. So it does go to show that it doesn't matter how much money you spend. There are other factors involved. And Wilkinson was, he was in line with what he was expected. And I think that that's probably a good thing.
It does kind of play into the ongoing frustration, I imagine, within the BC Liberal Party over, because this is following Christy Clark's leadership race, where there was a lot of talk about issues with the rules that went on there. And so it ultimately, like you say, it didn't matter because the guy who didn't break the rule won.
Yeah, this will probably get lost in the noise. But at the same time, it's not a great look that there isn't some sort of sanction for this. And I know in the federal conservative leadership race, candidates didn't get their deposits back if they broke some of the rules. Kevin O'Leary didn't get a bunch back because he missed some of the debates. And
he's still in like $600,000 worth of debt or something.
And Brad Trost also didn't get his deposit back because of the leak of the membership list to
the firearms group. Well, coming back to the ongoing Kinder Morgan reference question, last week I think we mentioned that Canada had applied to intervene, and well, now Saskatchewan has gone, us too, as they want to argue in this case that the federal government has more jurisdiction than the provincial government, which I just find funny for Saskatchewan because they just told the Supreme Court of Canada in the Como beer case that, no, we should be able to regulate our own beer. And they are in the process of writing a reference question that says they should have the control over their own carbon tax and the federal government can't implement it. But I guess this is all just politics, and that's how it will always play out.
Yeah, a lot of questions in the news right now. What's the question going to be?
Put it all to the courts. At least we know what the Kinder Morgan reference question is.
Yes. But
we'll look forward to getting Micah to read Saskatchewan's intervention and roll his eyes at them.
So speaking of Kinder Morgan, there's been a bit of controversy this week around the BC government's pension fund, and specifically that they've been investing in Kinder Morgan and other fossil fuel companies, despite the provincial government saying, we really don't like those people and what they want to do. And it's drummed up a little bit of controversy, but as a few different people pointed out, it's one of those things where you just don't really want your politicians setting the investment decisions for a pension fund.
Well, that included John Horgan himself saying that. And really felt like one of those things that's just kind of weird, but it actually isn't a story. Like, it's like,
yeah, as soon as you scratch beneath the surface, the controversy, I think, disappears, but it still made headlines for a day.
Yeah, half a day.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, we were talking about this earlier too, is, you know, I kind of thought, oh yeah, the hypocrisy. And then I realized that when I got my mortgage out, they, I think, automatically give you some sort of like an oil and gas type portfolio. And I thought, well, yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense that that would be something that the public service would look into. Again, like I'm going to go off on my cryptocurrency and Bitcoin thing. It's probably better that they're in Kinder Morgan and oil and gas than those types of industries at this point in time.
Yeah, we don't want the pension fund to half overnight.
No. So yeah, I would say that, yeah, when I kind of looked at it that way, I kind of thought it's a fair game.
Well, there could be a total element of insider trading if they're the government who then can...
That's another reason you want to keep them at arm's length.
We're going to invest as a government in Kinder Morgan. Oh, look who we just bought a bunch of stocks in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, the federal NDP has run into a bit more controversy as Jagmeet Singh has suspended another member of parliament following allegations. Christine Moore, who interestingly was one of the MPs who brought forward some of the initial complaints about Aaron Weir, who we talked about last week, a story came up about her sleeping with a veteran who had appeared before a committee she was at. And the veteran says, you know, it was all consensual, but looking back, maybe there was a power dynamic. And it was a really weird story based on how they kind of like went out of their way to find this guy. And so an investigation's going on now, which it's probably the right thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely the right thing to launch an investigation after this complaint.
And the NDP is weirdly one of the few federal parties dealing with Me Too, but Jagmeet Singh's taken a very strong, I will believe survivors and investigate these properly, which I think is the right stance.
Yeah, it's better than what the federal Liberals have done, where the process hasn't been nearly as transparent.
Well, there's criticism that the NDP's isn't that transparent because we still don't really know what the events around Aaron Weir has been. And that's let him kind of run around with the narrative saying, well, I'm just kind of awkward and I like stand too close to people. And
yeah, no one's great at these, but it's still better to have a independent investigator who says, you know, at least will give a yes, no answer to it, even if the details are hidden from view, then the Liberals, well, this guy's just no longer here, or we're shuffling him off because reasons.
Because reasons.
Well, the other federal NDP news, and I put out a third episode of Canby Report this week about this, is that Kennedy Stewart this morning announced he is going to run for mayor. And this was kind of not a well-kept secret. Mayor of Vancouver. He lives in Vancouver. He represents Burnaby South, though. And the more provincial federal news is that he's stepping down from his seat. Not effective immediately. He phrased it really weird in the press conference.
The session, I believe.
Yeah, he said the end of the session, but Trudeau hasn't really ended a session yet. And there's confusion about whether he ever will. Like, we might not have a prorogued parliament this year. So I think he meant the sitting. Like, he's going to finish the spring. Anyway, Kennedy's not going to be an MP this summer, which opens a by-election.
But could you really see someone with such strong Ontario roots? Like, I've seen this narrative floated that Jagmeet should go and run in that seat. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's even more bizarre to me than Kennedy Stewart running in Vancouver.
It's not a safe seat. The last election was fairly close, and Jagmeet Singh is from Ontario. That's where all of his roots are, and it's a high-risk move to go into a not-a-safe by-election. And then if you're the leader and you lose that, you've shot your political credibility right there.
100%.
Well, there have been politicians in the past who've come to BC. I think Tommy Douglas came and sat, held a seat in Burnaby, despite his long time as a...
The tradition is that someone in a safe seat gives up their seat for a new leader to run. And that hasn't happened yet. And he's already passed on a couple other by-elections, too.
Which, closer to home.
Yes. Which makes me think he isn't going to go for this one. He really should get into Parliament soon, because every day he's less relevant the longer he spends outside of it and doesn't get his face on the question period coverage.
And instead of having to talk about abuse allegations within his caucus, he could talk about the issues.
Nobody talks to Jagmeet Singh unless something bad is happening in the party these days.
I mean, that's kind of always true of third parties.
If you get like a clever quip in at question period or something, you'll at least get a short little clip on the news or something like that.
Well, I just even think, obviously, I'm not an NDP supporter at all, but I think that if I were running for prime minister with what the clock's now, they're on. I mean, the Conservatives just nominated someone in Diane Watts's seat, which Gordie Hogue, who was in my caucus, the BC Liberal caucus, now holds. And that's pretty early, because it's what, October 20th or something is the next election. So, yeah, they're nominating pretty early. And, you know, if I were running for prime minister, I would want some experience generally in the House of Commons before taking, like, the biggest role there. No offense, don't think he will become prime minister, but, you know, that would just be my thinking.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on the Burnaby by-election. I guess I meant to mention this off the top, but sort of a show housekeeping note. We stopped talking about Vancouver politics when you, Scott, were going to run for the NPA nomination, and that's not happening anymore.
No, it isn't. So, as you alluded to with the three Canby Report episodes this week...
We didn't do one last week, to be fair.
a lot's happened, and specifically within the NPA with Hector Bremner being disqualified for reasons that are not entirely clear, or at least not publicly clear, because... Seems like a internal power struggle more than anything else.
Unless you ask parts of Twitter, which are just toxic.
You should never ask Twitter questions about that sort of thing. So yeah, the process basically isn't going in the fair and open way they said it would. So I've decided to step back from the NPA. What happens after that is still being discussed and figured out. And I'll hopefully have an answer sometime next week on this one, and we'll see.
I know one bit of feedback we've gotten has been that people do like the focus on, or at least people outside Metro Vancouver like us not talking too much about, you know, False Creek development plans and very local issues.
Me included.
You included. And you live in Vancouver.
And I live in Vancouver, East Van.
And Canby Report is doing incredibly successful, like way more successful than I expected. It's almost getting the download numbers of this show, despite having a smaller audience. But... like you said, it's a shit show right now, and so everyone who is paying attention is paying a lot of attention. So I think we're going to continue on in this format, and we'll see where your nomination run takes you next, because this election is not getting quieter.
I'm British Columbia, Victoria's my capital, Canada's westmost province, touching the Pacific coast.
Well, and closing off today's show with the best of BC Poly, I wanted to highlight a Twitter account that came up a couple weeks ago, and I only discovered it a couple days ago, and it doesn't have a lot of followers yet, so you have to give this one a follow. It's at BC Poly Portraits, and it's someone anonymous who's in Victoria who is sketching out images of politicians, people in the press gallery, on Post-it notes, and just saying, "Hey, Rob Shaw." With a little Post-it note on Twitter.
They're really good, too.
They're adorable. And it's just quaint and sweet. They're nonpartisan portraitures. I don't think it's Justin McElroy, because if he did it, he would be proud of it and public about it. And I don't know if he's artistic. And there's no spreadsheet involved. I am happy to have them come on the show for a interview or something like that. We can do it anonymously. But yeah, go check out at BC Poly Portraits. We'll throw a link in the show notes. Going through them, they're just super cute. They've even like threw in a Camembert reference when Question Period was talking about that. They did our logo.
Yeah, I saw that.
That is awesome. I am so happy right now. Yeah. I was almost going to ask for them to do something like this, but cool. That's my shout out. I don't know if either of you saw anything fun on Twitter this last week.
Fun? No.
Happy. All right. Well,
my Twitter's been very narrowly focused in the last few days. So
mine too. Like, I haven't actually been following BC Poly this last week because I'm just like, oh, this is now happening. Oh, and two more things. Like, as I was editing this episode with Kennedy Stewart for Canby Report, the NPA blew up again. So there'll be lots more to happen on there, but do DM us or send us those tweets to hashtag best of BC Poly so that we can keep the segment going and be a little bit less bitter and toxic on the internet. That's what it's meant to be. Jillian, we didn't actually ask you to say where people can follow you on Twitter.
So I am on Twitter. I'm at Jillian P. Stead, Stead, S-T-E-A-D. I tweet occasionally.
And your show will be at?
Our Twitter account for the show is at Majority of BC. And of course, we've got the closed Facebook group. but we will be able to have that episode for download wherever you download your podcast apps by tonight.
Do you have a website?
We do have a website. It's majoritypodcast.ca.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was awesome.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicoast.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at politicoastpod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicoast. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.